Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last Friday's death of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher received wall-to-wall coverage this week. Most coverage focused on tributes and reaction from around the globe. President Obama said, quote, "The world has lost one of the great champions of freedom and liberty, and America has lost a true friend. Here in America, many of us will never forget her standing shoulder to shoulder with President Reagan, reminding the world that we are not simply carried along by the currents of history. We can shape them with moral conviction, unyielding courage, an iron will," end quote. There was a stark difference between coverage in the United States and coverage in the United Kingdom. Here in the States, we saw these headlines: New York Times, Thatcher, Reagan, and their special relationship; Real Clear Politics, Margaret Thatcher, Reagan's most resolute ally; CNN, Reagan and Thatcher, political soulmates. There was plenty of that kind of coverage in the UK, but there were also plenty of headlines and reaction from The Guardian that was very different. So, for example, you've got, "Unlike Margaret Thatcher, miners believed in society," a lot of reaction from union busting and miners; "Margaret Thatcher was no feminist." And then Glenn Greenwald, who used to be a columnist for Salon, wrote a column for The Guardian looking at why so few politicians and pundits decided not to criticize Margaret Thatcher. He believes this is the perfect time to criticize past policies. Well, joining us to talk about coverage is Zoe Williams, a columnist with The Guardian, and she joins us from London. Hi, Zoe. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, hi. Nice. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And on today's roundtable, we are also talking about coverage of President Obama's $3.7 trillion budget. Social Security and Medicare are getting most of the attention, although it also affects everything from the EPA to the Department of Education. The budget calls for $400 billion in cuts from Medicare over 10 years. It would also introduce a new cost of living measure that would mean an effective cut of $130 billion from Social Security benefits during the same period. And joining us to talk about that, as well as coverage of taxes, is Joshua Holland, an editor and senior writer at Alternet. Hi, Joshua. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Joshua, let's start off with you. What stood out for you this week?
Well, for me this week, it was a story by Jonathan Landay and McClatchy, "Obama's Drone War Kills Others, Not Just Al-Qaeda Leaders." And Jonathan dug into some documents, some internal documents, and found that, you know, while the administration always says that they are very careful about targeting only senior operational leaders of Al-Qaeda and people who may have been involved in the 9/11 attacks, what Landay found was that a review of the documents found that there was a lot of people who were kind of low-level, you know, militants, people who were involved in groups that did not exist in 9/11, people who were not active during 9/11. So the obvious takeaway is that, you know, we have this very opaque program. It's under the guidance of the CIA, all of this process of targeting is classified. We have to rely on the administration. It's telling us one thing, and clearly it's doing something else.
What does this mean for journalists who cover drones?
Well, I mean, it certainly means that they shouldn't be taking administration statements at face value. You know, the story quoted one of the experts, Mika Zenko, who I've spoken with as well, and he said, you know, it's clear that these findings, they show that the administration is misleading the public. I think that with drones, you know, we often miss the debate because it's portrayed as a debate among people who think that there's something inherently wrong with using new technologies. And I think that the actual debate among people who follow these issues much more closely is about the lack of transparency in the program, the fact that it is classified. There's actually a contingent within the administration itself that is saying, look, we should be more open about these processes. We shouldn't keep it all under, you know, close to our chests.
And then also, obviously, the angle of who these drones actually kill, and that what happens after they land in villages and neighborhoods, and how it affects people who live in these areas.
It traumatizes people. There was a report out by a couple of law of legal scholars. I believe it came out late last year. It was called Life Under Drones, and you know, it found they interviewed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people from these tribal areas, and found that people are just, you know, suffering from PTSD, and they don't know that they can leave their homes without becoming collateral damage to some sort of, you know, a missile coming out of the sky out of nowhere.
And then also there were protests as part of the April Days of Action organized by the Network to Stop Drone Surveillance and Warfare. And a number of members of Code Pink marched on military contractors like Northrop Grumman and General Atomics. And they also went in front of executives' homes. But this didn't get much attention. This happened earlier this week. So thank you. Kudos to Jonathan Landay at McClatchy. And we will link to that article right after the show. And what about you, Zoe? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Oh, I've just been reading something on Huffington Post UK today, actually, which is quite relevant just from for a kind of UK counterpoint to the American situation with welfare. We're obviously having an identical welfare battle as the coalition tries to cut our welfare payments. And Simon Duffy, who's actually heads a research group on welfare, has written a wonderful piece about food stamps and preloaded benefit cards and how and what they mean for human dignity.
And so he was writing about this, about food stamps in the UK?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously you've had these in America for such a long time that it's not such a talking point, but we've never had a food stamp culture. And now, just as we start, local councils are starting to institute them, and people are talking at a national level about bringing in benefits on a preloaded card, which you can't spend on certain things. It's a huge, it's hugely meaningful, I think, and Simon Duffy thinks, for the kind of idea of citizenship and what you have a right to expect from your government, you know, and what you have a what your role is in society if you're not economically productive. And I think it's going to be bitterly contested.
Well, here in the U.S., we've got 48 million citizens on food stamps. What is the number in the U.K.?
Well, at the moment, it's almost none. But basically, what they've done is a tiny incremental move, but it's quite ideologically significant, but it's not huge in terms of money. They've taken what used to be the crisis fund for people who, for one reason or another, had no money at all and were between benefits checks, and they've transmuted that into a food stamp or a food bank system. So basically, people who used to be able to go and get £50 for a kind of emergency bridging loan now have to get that money in food stamps. It's really the important thing is whether or not this paves the way for a wider use of food stamps, because as I'm sure you know, it's very stigmatizing and it's very, it's kind of dehumanizing. It's very, you know, to be ejected from the world of money and put in this kind of outer periphery of the economy where your only forms of barter are kind of bags of food. And UK politics has always rejected it as a solution until now.
Well, and Zoe, just to let you know, to get rid of that stigma in the U.S., there is now a credit card. So the person behind you has no idea that you're using food stamps.
Oh, well, that's beneficial. But in a way, we have this system for asylum seekers that's called the Azure Card. And it's very... people who are on it say it's also very stigmatizing because it's very obvious and you're treated differently in shops, and the shop assistant knows who you are. You're not allowed to buy on the Azure card. You're not allowed to buy condoms or sanitary products.
Yeah,
so it's really kind of obvious and horrible. And I spoke to somebody yesterday who said she stood behind a woman who was turned down from trying to buy some crayons for her child.
Oh, wow.
And it's just really brutal, you know.
Well, you know, since you brought this up, Zoe, let's just dive right in and talk about coverage of the death of Margaret Thatcher. I mean, it was so interesting to look at the coverage in the U.S. and the U.K., and I guess not so surprising because she was a former leader of your country, but she was very, very close to Ronald Reagan. And, you know, what we noticed is that in the U.S., so much of it was really about what world leaders said, and there wasn't really much difference. I mean, President Obama to Reagan to Clinton, you name it. But in the U.K., there were some many, many articles, really, about how her policies affected the poor when she was in power and how to this day they still affect the poor. So since you brought this issue of food stamps up, can you talk about just what you've seen in the U.K., especially on this issue?
Yeah, no, I'd love to. So what I think, there are two strands to the kind of negative coverage of Thatcher's period of rule. One of them is the kind of big flashpoints, the kind of large gestural political manoeuvres she made, which were very important. You know, the Falklands War was a huge deal for the left, just waging a war for purely jingoistic purposes. There was no real sense in us keeping the Falklands. And that gesture was kind of giving two fingers to reasonable politics in a way. It was saying, you might have the arguments on your side, but I've got patriotism, and patriotism will win. And then they're kind of, in terms of taxation, the poll tax, which you may or may not have heard of over there, it was basically taxing people by the number of people in their household. So it was a specific penalization for being overcrowded. It was like a deliberated move to make the poor pay more tax than the rich. So it's quite extraordinary. It's quite an extreme. Those are two very extreme examples of what she did at the time and what the left really resented at the time. And I remember at the time going on marches both against the Falklands War and against the poll tax. And those, if you were asked to kind of do, I don't know, a sitcom about what Thatcher was like and what life was like under Thatcher, those are the two things you'd talk about. But much more interesting and almost immediate on the day she died was the people who were looking around at the economic situation we're in now, which is absolutely dire, and seeing how much of the problem, how many of the problems we have, had their roots in the Thatcher era.
And Josh, what are your thoughts on what you saw here in the U.S.? I read a couple of the headlines, but so much of it was about her special relationship with Reagan and just sort of quoting various leaders in the U.S.
I think she was very significant in advancing Reagan's project. I mean, right, Reagan came in and his economic policies would have been a complete aberration if not for, you know, Margaret Thatcher kind of validating this in an international context. They shared the same zeal for union busting, and they ended up achieving similar economic changes in the time that they were in office. You know, when Thatcher came in, basically England was the most equal economy that had ever existed. And that's changed very, very rapidly. When Reagan came in, you know, the top 1% of households had taken 10% of the national pre-tax income since the end of the war, and it had been very, very consistent. He left, and they were taking 16%. Now they're taking 20%. He started this ball rolling. They both shared the same zeal for supporting dictators because they believed in stability over democracy and human rights, and I think that again these were very important to each other in terms of validating this Reagan-Thatcher approach to governance.
That is Joshua Holland, an editor and senior writer at Alternet. Zoe Williams is a columnist with The Guardian. And Zoe will be with us for about 10 more minutes. If you, and I'm sure you heard and read plenty of coverage this week about the death of Margaret Thatcher and her relationship with Ronald Reagan, what really stood out for you? And which outlets went beyond the accolades from, you know, everybody from President Obama to George H.W. Bush, and really looked at the policies of these two politicians and their lasting legacies that still affect us to this very day? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. In fact, the Washington Post had a piece saying that a lot of the deregulation, when you look at Reagan and Thatcher, could be traced exactly to the economic crisis of 2008. So what are your thoughts on the coverage? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Zoe, when something like this happens, and because her policies were so instrumental for so many people, from miners to bankers and everyone in between, how should this be covered? Because here's what the Associated Press said, and I read something like this in so many articles. For admirers, Thatcher was a savior who rescued Britain from ruin and laid the groundwork for an extraordinary economic renaissance. For critics, she was a heartless tyrant who ushered in an era of greed that kicked the weak out onto the streets and let the rich become filthy rich. So what are your thoughts about that? And can't you look at the facts and decide sort of how her policies actually played out over the decades?
Well, exactly so. I think there would be some benefit. It's too much to ask, obviously, in such an emotional week, but there would be some benefit in actually looking at the facts, because all the people who are praising her for revivifying Britain's economic fortunes are conveniently omitting to notice that we discovered the North Sea oil in that period. That was why our fortunes were reawakened. It was nothing to do with deregulation. It's really galling to suddenly find yourself at the sharp end of this very neoliberal worldview, which looks at that period of prosperity and places it at the door of a woman who could never have invented oil. You know, I mean, it just happened to be there. In terms of the germ of the policies which we're still seeing play out, obviously banking deregulation was a huge thing for you guys and a huge thing for us. And I think, very much as Joshua said, they really cheered each other up, Thatcher and Reagan. Things that would have seemed very unreasonable from one of them suddenly gained a kind of credence when both of them were doing it. And I think without that period, without that complete failure to regulate the casino banks and separate them from high street banks, we wouldn't be in anything like the situation we're in today. However, obviously the banking crisis gets all the headlines, and rightly so, because it's going to be so influential for so long. But I think in terms of society, and I don't blame Thatcher entirely, because don't forget we had three terms of a Labour government who failed to reverse all this, so we can't blame her all over. But in terms of society, I think our major impacts were things... We're not the kind of deliberated, every man for himself, poor guy on the street type headline stuff, but rather just the steady kind of conservative, laissez-faire, dim-wittedness, which kind of leaves... You know, we have a real proper housing crisis in the UK now, because all the social housing was sold off. This was billed as a huge boost to the poor, where people who had rented from their council for three generations were suddenly allowed to buy their flat at a reduced price. But really, when you look at the data now, only 30% of those original social houses are still in ordinary hands. 70% of the housing is now in the hands of people who are landlords. So it was a huge redistribution of wealth away from the public purse towards private racketeers. And it's got us into a situation where a normal wage in the UK will not cover a normal rent, and we spend a huge amount of taxpayers' money subsidising that, and that causes a lot of poverty. So just in terms of that one policy, she comes out and says, we're going to sell off social housing. Everybody says, yay, this is great for the poor. And that will burn into our economic landscape. It's burnt into it already in 30 years. It's going to burn into it for the next 30. And to think that a policy like that would influence most the economic picture for a huge number of people for most of a century is really striking. It really makes you think that it's no joke being in government, and actually having a reputation for being decisive isn't necessarily the best reputation to have. Sometimes it's good to take advice and listen to it.
And that is Zoe Williams. She is a columnist with The Guardian. A number of really interesting columns about Margaret Thatcher this week. Unlike Margaret Thatcher, miners believed in society. Ken Capstick wrote that piece. He wrote, miners were the, quote, enemy within. Their communities were targeted for destruction. If there is rejoicing at her death, bear this in mind. And Josh, it's interesting to look at Glenn Greenwald, because he was a columnist for Salon, and he's now writing for The Guardian. And he wrote that the dictate that one, quote, not speak ill of the dead is at best appropriate for private individuals, not influential public figures. So he basically said people should really look at her past. And he wrote, she played a key role not only in bringing about the first Gulf War, but also using her influence to publicly advocate for the 2003 attack on Iraq. She denounced Nelson Mandela and his ANC as, quote, terrorists, something even David Cameron admitted was wrong. She was a steadfast friend to brutish tyrants such as Augusto Pinochet and Indonesian dictator Suharto. I mean, he goes on and on and on, as you can imagine. But what about history? I mean, in some of the media coverage in the United States, when you look at Reagan and Thatcher, I mean, there's a lot of history to look at there. Did you see much of this explored in the articles?
Well, I mean, in the U.S. press, certainly there was very little of that. It was all basically hagiography about, you know, how wonderful she was. I'm a little bit divided here. I mean, I agree with what Glenn is saying, in that, you know, we shouldn't feel a prohibition against examining these very, very significant historical figures and the impact that they had on society. At the same time, I'm not going to blame editors for, you know, going easy when somebody has recently passed. I think that there is a basic human instinct to not speak ill of the dead. So I'm kind of a little bit in between this. I'm a moderate on this question.
Well, don't you think there's a difference between speaking ill of the dead and talking about her or his policies?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think that it's important to look at when it's a very significant historical figure like this, then that is the time that it is appropriate to look at the impact that they had. I just don't, you know, I don't give editors a hard time for, I understand where they're coming from, as far as the day-to-day reality of publishing. You know, I see that there would be a caution of going too deeply into these issues, for fear also of a public backlash. I mean, editors are real people, and they have to look at their email, and they get a lot of very angry correspondence when they publish controversial things. So I have an empathy for those who have kind of taken it easy in the immediate aftermath.
Well, we've got a number of calls on this, so let's hear from Brenda in San Francisco. Hi, Brenda. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Rose. Well, I would highly recommend that people go to YouTube and Google the tirade that Glenda Jackson launched in against Thatcher in a debate about what kind of tribute should be paid to her. I don't know whether the tribute was associated with her burial or whether it was just going to happen in Parliament. And apparently, at the end of her speaking, of course, she was an actress, and so she certainly knew her lines, and just she was amazing. And then Tony Baldry, who was another MP, intervened to ask the Speaker if her comments were in order. And the Speaker basically put him in his place in the most beautiful, restrained fashion possible. And I just would recommend that everybody watch it, because this will really outline what Thatcherism was like when Jackson was there and I no longer was. But anyway, it's definitely not to be missed.
All right. Thank you for that, Brenda. We'll put a link on the website right after the show. Let's take another call and then we'll get a response. Let's hear from Bob in Brisbane. Hi, Bob.
Oh, hi there. Well, I just wanted to first say I get all my news from public radio, and I don't have a TV, so I've been really impressed with how balanced the coverage has been, both, you know, her pluses and her negatives. What really struck me was that I don't remember this with Reagan. Now, I don't know if anybody there is old enough to remember when Reagan died, but I felt very alone. I wasn't really hearing, you know, what a horrible president he was and what terrible things he did. It was lording him all over the place, which I think was a really dangerous thing, because today people think that he was this saint. So I think it's really important when somebody passes to be critical of, you know, what they were like. So does anybody there remember Reagan? Am I just imagining this? Was maybe I missing the criticism, or did we just lord him up?
Well, I'll ask our guests right after a quick break, and thank you for calling in. We're talking today about media coverage of the death of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, and we're going to stick with this for a few more minutes, and then we'll talk about coverage of President Obama's budget, Social Security, and Medicare. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
Yet Thatcherites were nigh, Linden ear, Linden ear. Yet Thatcherites were nigh, Linden ear. Yet Thatcherites were nigh, your faults I will proclaim, your doctrines I must blame. You will hear, you will hear, your doctrines I must blame. You will hear. Your private eyes away, what is ours, what is ours? Your private eyes away, what is ours? Your private eyes away.
and then you make us pay. I will take it back someday, mark my words, mark my words. We'll take it back someday, mark my words. You thought you liked my name, Lyndon E.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the Monsanto Protection Act. You maybe heard about this after it was slipped into the budget bill. It took a lot of people by surprise. President Obama did sign it. And basically what it does is it's a provision that exempts biotech firms like Monsanto from judicial review. So we'll talk about how this got in the budget, who was behind this act, what would it do, and what precedent does this set. How many Monsanto executives now work in the U.S. government? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Joshua Holland is an editor and senior writer at Alternet, and Zoe Williams is a columnist with The Guardian. And before we let you go, Zoe, do you remember the media coverage when Ronald Reagan passed away, and what did you think about Bob's comments?
Well, I mean, I was really nodding with agreement when Bob was speaking, because, A, I do remember, and obviously we had the same experience in reverse then, that there was no negative comment at all from the UK press. It was all, you know, a nation fondly remembers its heartthrob president, that kind of thing. And I think there's a very interesting point here. Because of the speaking ill of the dead conventions, people aren't encouraged to make an honest appraisal of somebody's period in government the minute they've died. But, of course, as soon as the minute has passed, nobody really wants to carry on talking about it. So it does end up that the picture you get for some time after somebody has died is a very rosy one. And that is, as Bob said, quite a damaging, you know, that's not a great outcome. If all presidents are going to be remembered fondly because they've died, I mean, it's not a great kind of result for human reason.
Well, do you think that in the coming weeks, reporters might feel more, I don't know, comfortable maybe to really look back at this history and how it's still affecting us to this day?
Well, I mean, certainly in the UK at the moment, I think politics are so polarized that it's very, very difficult to have a kind of reasoned conversation about anything. There are very loud people saying Thatcher was our savior and very loud people saying Thatcher was a devil. And very few people saying, let's actually look at public policy, see what levers a government can reasonably pull, and see, you know, where those levers have taken us and whether that's where we wanted to go. That conversation is not happening in the UK at the moment, as it isn't happening in Europe. I mean, I'm sure this has been really obvious from America's distance, that we're all in some kind of chaos,
yeah.
In terms of our debating landscape. Hopefully, when things pick up economically, we'll kind of see a little bit more sobriety in the debate.
Well, believe me, we know exactly what you're talking about here in the U.S. So, Zoe, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's Friday night there, and I appreciate it. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. That is Zoe Williams. She's a columnist with The Guardian joining us from London. We are also joined by Joshua Holland. He'll be with us for the rest of the show, editor and senior writer at Alternet. And now I would like to welcome Trudy Lieberman to the show. Trudy is a longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, where she covers healthcare, and she closely follows media coverage of healthcare, Social Security, and Medicare. Hi, Trudy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me again.
Great to have you. So, you know, Trudy, I just want to ask you, because we've been spending about 25 minutes on the death of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and we've been talking just about, you know, reporters' responsibility to really look at the policies of these politicians and look at how they've affected us over the last four decades and continue to affect us. And I wonder what you think about this, because you're looking at everything from the embrace of the so-called free market, attacking unions, wage stagnation, going after social services. What are your thoughts, and what really struck you about coverage of these issues in the U.S. press this week?
Well, as you know, I've been covering Social Security and Medicare very, very closely for CJR.org. And my take on it is that the media have not really discussed what these policies will do for ordinary people. And I keep writing about it, urging the media and my fellow journalists to kind of tell people what these policies will really do for them, because they're going to have profound effects on most people. Just take the change CPI, for example, with Social Security. The hints had been dropped for a long time that the Obama budget was going to call for this alternative way of calculating a cost of living formula. And the cost of living formula, if we make the changes, and Congress agrees to make these changes, will save a lot of money for the government, something like $130 billion. And so the deficit hawks and the fiscal conservatives have had their eye on this for a long time. Changing this is going to be difficult on a lot of people, because while it has been portrayed as a technical fix, and you often hear the administration officials and supporters of this call it a technical fix, it's really more than that. It's a method that changes the way cost of living adjustments will be calculated so that they will amount to a benefit cut over time. And the thing about it that is not really well understood is that these cuts compound. At first, they're pretty benign, but over time, they compound and really begin to affect people when they are in very old age. And that's when people really need the income the most. We find that when people reach their 80s, their assets have pretty much been used up. Mm-hmm. Either they've had to live on them or they've had health problems. So taking away $1,000 from, say, an 85-year-old is kind of a big deal.
Well, and you point out that according to the advocacy group Social Security Works, the change could mean that an 85-year-old would have $1,139 a year less to live on. And, you know, what I'm not hearing, and this is getting so much attention, what I'm not hearing is what is the average Social Security benefit today?
Oh, it's about $1,100, something like that. And it's not very much. And women particularly older women, are really going to feel this pinch because they typically have less income, their Social Security benefits are lower, and they don't live on very much. And I think one statistic is that half of all Medicare beneficiaries live on $22,000 or less. Mm-hmm. And the other part of the equation, and this has not been... The dots have not been connected by the media very carefully on this, despite our urgings to get people to sort of think about it this way, that people are spending, many Medicare beneficiaries are spending about one-third of their income on medical care, and that is even with Medicare, which is a social insurance program that has been a savior to many older people, you know, since it was passed in the mid-1960s. And so there have been changes proposed in the Obama budget that will make changes on the Medicare side for people coming up through the ranks in the next decade or so. And they're going to feel the effects of this and find that they're going to have to pay a lot more out of pocket. So when you diminish the cost of living formula on Social Security, begin to pinch on the revenue side, you're also going to hurt people on the expense side, too, if they have to pay more out of pocket for their medical care. And that dot has never really been connected very well by the national media.
And Josh, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, these are really important facts, that the average Social Security recipient is getting about $1,100 a month, and this CPI change would mean about $1,139 a year less to live on. But these facts aren't in a lot of the articles. How do you explain that?
Well, I explain that, I guess, by the fact that a lot of the articles are written by people who don't expect to rely on Social Security. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is so crucial, what Trudy was saying about how the context within which all of this is happening just seems to be completely missing. I mean, you're talking about a $15,000 annual benefit. And the thing, we were talking about Reagan and Thatcher. A larger context is that we have a massive retirement crisis, in large part due to this very, very significant shift from, you know, defined benefit pensions, which a lot of people had in the 60s and 70s, to these 401ks. And you know, this means that they took away one of the three stools of retirement security. It was supposed to be you had your Social Security, you had your savings and investments, whatever you could squirrel away, and then you had something from your employer that you could count on altogether. And now, you know, we're talking about a $15,000 annual benefit. I want to point out that a quarter of all retirees have nothing else except for that. You know, and you, if you look at, for example, Hispanics, that's over 40%. African Americans, it's over 40% of those retirees have nothing but that $15,000 average. Well, I mean, that's an average. Have nothing but their Social Security benefits. So these cuts are going to be extremely significant. And as Trudy said, we hear about it as this kind of modest technical, you know, fix. There's a real contradiction there. They say that they're making a more accurate measure of inflation, basically the cost of living, and yet they also say that they're going to protect the neediest. Well, which is it? If it's more accurate, then why would they need to protect anybody? This is something that just doesn't really make sense on its face. And the other thing is that, you know, it may be that change CPI is more accurate for, say, a middle-aged worker. That's possible. Studies have shown that the cost of living goes up more for the elderly because of the reasons that we're talking about with, for example, paying more out of pocket for health care. Healthcare costs, as we all know, expand much more rapidly than other goods and services. And so we should be really thinking about a cost of living adjustment that is more accurate for older people rather than more supposedly more accurate for the public at large.
That is Joshua Holland. He is editor and senior writer at Alternet. We're also joined by Trudy Lieberman, longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and she closely follows media coverage of healthcare, Social Security, and Medicare. And we've noticed, Trudy, you've been very busy the past 2 weeks. You've written a number of stories about how this is being covered in outlets from the New York Times to National Public Radio. What's really stood out for you? Who's getting it right? Who's getting it wrong? And who's actually going beyond the he said, he said?
Well, I think, you know, I know you like to start off your shows with positive stuff, and I do want to point out that Michael Lind had a really good piece earlier this week, or maybe it was the end of last week, on we're really taking the wrong direction in terms of Social Security, this whole mantra of cut, 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 and let's take it away from people, when we really should be looking at Social Security as part of this larger picture of retirement income. And I think that is not being discussed. We're not talking about benefit improvements. We haven't talked about benefit improvements in decades. But we have a looming crisis in this country with retirement income. And I think that if any good comes out of this discussion, maybe it will spur the discussion in a different direction to look at what we have to live on in retirement. And your last guest is absolutely correct. We have lost defined benefit plans. Most people don't even have a pension plan anymore. And Social Security will become, and is already for many people, their sole source of retirement income. And it's really going to be tough to live on that. And so what we need from the media and pundits and everybody else, we need to start thinking about other ways that we can fund retirement. And there's a lot of proposals out there and talk about different tiers and different levels, but still maintaining the integrity of social insurance as a social insurance program. And we're not even there yet. And add to this, compounding this problem, is the pulling away from Medicare as a social insurance program too, which a lot of people in Washington would very much like to do. We're going to have people who don't have the income, and they're not going to have a way to pay for health care. And I don't see that health care costs are going down, and this is just, you know, not in the cards right now. And so I think, you know, looking at the people I interview when I get out in the rest of the country and talk to people, and I see a real issue here, and I haven't seen the press tackle it. It's very difficult to get reporters to go out and talk to actual people, and I didn't quite understand that. You know, we used to like anecdotes so much, but you really learn a lot when you go out and visit with people and look at their budgets and find out what they have to live on. And I think that's a very different view than you get from the policy wonks in Washington, because Josh is absolutely right. The people in Washington don't expect to live on this. They're making a lot of money now, and they don't have a lot of empathy for the little guy.
And what about possible solutions? TrueThought has a piece called White House and Senate Democrats Should Eliminate Social Security Tax Cap for the Rich, Stop the CPI Scam on the Elderly. And TrueThought has pointed this out. Robert Reich is talking about this. The New York Times ran an op-ed about this a few years ago. By eliminating the payroll tax earnings cap and ending this regressive exemption for the top 5.2% of earners would, according to the Congressional Budget Office, solve the financial crisis facing the Social Security system. Trudy, are you seeing this in any other place besides alternative media and the occasional op-ed?
No. This is a solution. It's an option that is not on the table. I've been writing a lot lately about what is not on the table, particularly as it relates to Medicare. But the option of raising the payroll tax cap has been around for a very long time, and it doesn't get much play. It's not part of what the media want to talk about, because they're listening to only certain people. They want to bring certain people onto their shows, and nobody's talking about raising this tax cap in any meaningful way. And I think that that change, a lot of people believe that that change would fix whatever shortfall exists in the Social Security system. And to be fair, the system is not in perfect health, and that if something does have to be done to kind of make sure that 100% of benefits will be paid out after something like 20, 33, or 34. But that option would fix that problem, according to many experts, but it really isn't getting much traction. And I am always urging the media to kind of broaden the discussion and let people understand that there's other things we can talk about, and that is not getting through.
Rose, can I jump in? And
sure.
I just want to point out that, you know, it is true that according to the projections from the Social Security trustees, there is a shortfall, but these are long-term projections, and we treat them as if they are, you know, etched in stone. And history shows that long-term projections have been wildly off. The Social Security is, in fact, very solvent for the next two decades. And when we look at other programs, we don't usually say, well, we may have a problem in 40 years or 30 years. Nobody's ever said, well, we have an unfunded military budget, you know, gap. We should not, you use the word crisis. Social Security is certainly not in crisis. And, you know, I want to talk about just one other piece of this. We talk about this, always we talk about the elderly, but we have a youth unemployment crisis mm-hmm. in this country. And we've made it very, very hard to retire. We've done that in a number of ways by, again, shifting from defined benefit to 401ks. And we should be making it easier for people to retire. We should be talking about lowering the retirement age, the eligibility age for Social Security and Medicare. We should be talking about increasing benefits in order to also help the younger part of the workforce. Because what we see is that the labor participation rate among the elderly is increasing as it becomes harder and harder to retire.
Right.
And, you know, we have very, very high unemployment rates for kids that are coming out of college. We should be figuring out ways to encourage people who are older to, you know, enjoy themselves a little bit, get out of the workforce, and free up some of these jobs.
Well, that is Joshua Holland, senior editor and writer at Alternet. And Trudy Lieberman is a longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. We have just about 5 or 6 minutes left. We'd love to hear from you on media coverage of these issues. What are your thoughts? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. We got kudos to Michael Hudson. His piece was on Alternet this week, Josh, from a listener, and it says, Margaret Thatcher was a privatization pioneer, and this is the story of how her agenda did nothing but make life worse for millions of people. This the one essay you need to read to understand what a pernicious ideology free market privatization really is. So we got kudos to Alternet there and Michael Hudson. And I wanted to also ask you just quickly before we go back to a few calls, the major media outlets are really describing people who are against these cuts as, quote, part of the liberal establishment or left-leaning. And Derek Thompson has a piece at The Atlantic called Reality Check, Obama Cuts Social Security and Medicare by Much More than the GOP. He says President Obama is already to the right of the right. And yet, when you look at surveys, like from the Kaiser Family Foundation, 61% of the public, I'm sorry, 71% want to cut the military budget, 58% want no cuts to Medicare or Social Security. What are your thoughts about how the media are framing this, Josh?
Well, I mean, to make it seem like it's all liberal opposition is quite patently ridiculous. There was a poll of Tea Partiers, and maybe a year and a half ago, and it found 70% of Tea Partiers opposed cuts to Social Security, Medicare. The idea that these are the kind of liberal establishment is ludicrous, and it sets it up along very traditional partisan lines or ideological lines. And what that does is I think people put up blinders, you know, conservatives, moderates, people who may not agree with liberals on other issues say, wait a second, maybe this is not a legitimate criticism. And I think that that's really problematic.
And yes, Trudy, go ahead.
Can I jump in on that point? I think that I've been covering this now for 3 decades, Social Security, and in this last go-around, I see people referred to as supporters of Social Security or Social Security advocates. They have twisted, before that, everybody supported Social Security. There wasn't really this dichotomy about opponents and supporters. So somehow the framing and the language has changed in the last few years, in this last go-around to try to do something about Social Security. And that has never been the case before, that this is a universal program with universal support. And I want to point out that even Mrs. Thatcher was not able to change the NHS or get rid of the NHS, which is the National Health Service in Britain, even though I think that was probably one of the things that she had in mind, and certainly the conservatives in Britain did when she came to power. And so I think we have to sort of think about supporters of Social Security versus opponents of Social Security, and then that gets into this liberal establishment, and that's exactly how the press has portrayed it, actually.
Well, and a lot of comments I've been reading on articles about this say that it would be political suicide for a Republican to do this. It would take a Democrat to go after Social Security and Medicare. Well, because you've been reporting on this for so long, why do you think the Obama administration is doing this?
I really don't have an answer to that question. I mean, it is a bit mystifying because Social Security had been the bedrock of Democratic theology, if you want to call it that, for years. I mean, the programs came from FDR and from Lyndon Johnson, and there's been kind of a whittling away at that, and you find conservative senators supporting Republicans on this. And in some cases, they've been very vocal about cutting Medicare in particular. And I don't understand, you know, why they're doing that. And I just can't believe that they're in tune with all the people in their districts.
Josh, what's your take on that?
Well, Paul Krugman said that they were trying to impress the, you know, Washington Post editorial board. I think that there's something to that. I would go a little bit deeper. I think that everybody knows that this budget is not going to become law. It has things like universal pre-K funded with cigarette taxes. It has the so-called Buffett rule, which raises taxes on people like Mitt Romney to the same level as their secretaries. This is not going to pass the Republican-dominated House. And I think that the White House strategy, which I should make clear, I think is a wildly misguided strategy, is to highlight the intransigence of the GOP. I think that they've had this on the table for, you know, 2 years, 3 years, they've been saying that they would be willing to consider change CPI in exchange for, you know, for ending this kind of endless fiscal showdowns, this endless series of fiscal showdowns for killing the sequester at this point. And I think that that hasn't come through to the public that clearly. And this was a way, in the administration's mind, to really drive home that they were the ones who were going to be flexible, be willing to, you know, make concessions to the right, to highlight the fact that they will not get a response, that they don't have a negotiating partner. Again, I think this is very misguided, but I have to think that that is the administration's thinking.
We have an email from Greg who says, this is the outcome I expected from Obama. The sequestration supposedly is a flat cut across everything, including the Department of Imperial Overreach. But the bloated DOD and War Departments are sacrosanct with everyone in power from Dems to Republicans. So my understanding is that the budget actually gives the DOD a bonus compensating offset for its share of the cuts in addition to their annual budget increase. Can any of you touch that answer that question?
That's not true. The budget has less for, it's true that it is less than the sequester, but it's still a cut. I think it's 527 billion. So that's a cut of about 100 billion.
And Trudy, where does this go from here? Because you've got some Republicans actually saying that Obama is going after the elderly. I mean, it's amazing to watch this.
Well, I think the politics are going to be really interesting. I mean, the Republicans were very good at turning around the Medicare cuts, supposed Medicare cuts that were like cuts to providers rather than beneficiaries. First there was the $500 billion and then the $700 billion cut, your listeners may remember. And I think that, maybe we're going to have some discussion about this. I mean, we've been writing about the chain CPI for the last 2 years. And now everybody seems to be writing about the chain CPI. So perhaps people will kind of understand it. And I would hope that we can have a discussion about Medicare. Right now, last week, we haven't really had much about Medicare. So people don't really know what Obama has proposed and what Republicans have proposed and some Democrats.
And on that one, just quickly, Trudy, the Physicians for National Health came out with a press release this week saying that the administration intervenes to give $71 billion to overpaid for-profit Medicare Advantage plans. That hasn't gotten any attention this week.
No, we...
You
we
wrote about it.
Yeah. Nobody in the press has picked it up that I could see.
Wow.
There was supposed to be a 2.3% cut to Medicare Advantage plans. You may recall that these plans had been overpaid for some time now by the federal government, and Obama did come into office saying he was going to cut that. So the insurance industry ran a big campaign, and they got a 3% increase.
Well, we will definitely cover this and do a show. It's really important. Trudy Lieberman, longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Joshua Holland, senior writer at Alternet. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What's in the Monsanto Protection Act? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about a provision in the budget bill that exempts biotech firms like Monsanto from judicial review. According to Food and Water Watch, Monsanto's board members have worked for the EPA, advised the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and served on President Obama's Advisory Committee for Trade Policy and Negotiations. So who was behind this act? What would it do exactly? And what precedent does this set? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.